Welcome to the Pitt Rivers Museum's Matters of Policy podcast. This is a podcast in which we explore the museum's collections development policy, speaking with guests from across the globe to delve into the language used and consider what really matters in this policy.
Content warning. This episode discusses issues surrounding Canadian residential schools and colonial harm to Indigenous communities.
Hi, it's Megan. I'm here with Alexis today to interview Master Carver Carrie Newman.
Professor Newman is an Indigenous multidisciplinary scholar and artist who works at the University of Victoria. His most famous work is called The Witness Blanket, which sheds light on Canada's history of Indigenous genocide. He's here today to talk about pathways forward for the museum.
Just to get started, I'd like to do a quick land acknowledgement just because I am on Indigenous land today. So I am a white settler of Celtic and British descent living on Treaty 1 territory, which is the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, the Innu Ojibwe, the Innu Cree, Oji Cree, Dene, and Dakota peoples, as well as the homeland of the Métis Nation. And obviously I acknowledge that colonialism and genocide continues to deeply harm Indigenous communities in the land now called Canada, and I'm committed to listening and doing the work and learning as much as I can in the service of truth, reconciliation, and restitution.
I just want to introduce myself in my traditional way. Yo, Nuguam, Carrie Newman, Haman Bachlam Tla'i, Hayal Kingame. Through my father, I'm Kukwakiwak from the Kukwekum, Giksam, and Wawalabai clans of northern Vancouver Island, and Coast Salish from Chiam of the Stalo Nation along the Upper Fraser Valley, both of which are places in what is now called British Columbia, Canada. Through my mother, my ancestors are settlers of English, Irish, and Scottish heritage, and I'm coming to you today from the traditional territories of the Lekwungen-speaking people, which are now called Victoria, British Columbia. So, on to your question.
Our question is, how do you feel that museums going forward can better acknowledge the emotional and spiritual connection between objects and people? Because the current policy doesn't really do that.
I was reading through the policy manual that you sent, and it's interesting because you can sort of see a couple of different things happening at the same time, right? Like there's this like pragmatic approach to like the finances of and resources of a museum, right? And then there's another layer where there's this attention paid to the origin of the object, but not necessarily like all the way back to where it came from, but who has it right now and who's donating it, or where the funds came from to acquire it. So like, sort of noticing in there that that's kind of in second place is we must make sure that our donors are well taken care of in all the decisions we make. And for me, I would flip that a little bit and I would place primary importance on the object itself and the community that it came from. That would be my first consideration on everything. Yeah, it's fascinating to listen to the language or to read the language and hear, see terms like disposal. And that's like such a final kind of, and like get rid of. that's what that means, right? Like when I dispose of something, I throw it in the trash. And so I see that language throughout the document thinking, wow, right? That's kind of a final way of looking at it. And I started to imagine what it would be like. Well, and maybe we'll get into that a little bit further forward into the conversation, but I don't think of my relationship with the objects or the materials that I encounter as being transactional. I think of them as being relational. So if I acquire a tree to turn it into a totem, I'm in relationship with that log, with the spirit in that log, and I have a responsibility to treat it in the best way possible. And for me, that comes out of cultural teachings, right? So in the case of another project I did called The Witness Blanket, where I was bringing in objects from residential schools, from residential school survivors, churches, government buildings, in an effort to kind of record the truth of the history of residential school in Canada, I formed a relationship with each of the people who gave the objects, with the objects themselves, and that is what informed my decision-making around, I mean, it still informs it, around how to build the work of art, but also in what happens next. So in my case, it went on tour to try and get it back to the communities it came from, and it eventually needed to be installed. Some are semi-permanent, and so it now is in the Canadian Museum for Human Rights and as part of an exhibition called Preserving a Legacy. And the museum is undergoing the process of conservation of the blanket while it's set up there to ensure that it's around for as long as it's supposed to be.
I think that sort of leads us into our next question, which was about the witness blanket. Your work with the witness blanket birthed a unique agreement with the CMHR. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, about how you think museums can develop or continue this kind of work going forward and the sort of impacts that you think it has had?
Sure. What I was just saying about my relationship with the pieces and the stories that they carry and the people who gave them, that is what led me to the decision to make the kind of agreement that we made. We call it a stewardship agreement. It's a written contract and an oral agreement. The oral aspect of the agreement was, let's just say, initiated or enacted through ceremony. But the sort of core principle of the agreement is that nobody owns the blanket. That all rights associated with the agreement rest with the blanket and those pieces and the stories that it carries, and that we, instead of negotiating rights, like so often happen in that kind of a contract, we negotiated responsibility. And in doing so, we outlined the parameters of our relationship, my relationship with the museum. But we also outlined the parameters of our relationship with the object, with the witness blanket. And then by enacting this whole thing through ceremony, we invited community in through the act of witnessing to take part in that stewardship with us. And so the goal of this is for us to act always in the best interest of the blanket itself, to not think about the transactional value, to not think of it even as property or a possession. And so actually, when I was reading through the policy manual, I was thinking about the places in which the stipulations of what will and will not occur based on this policy would at the very least inhibit this kind of an agreement, because it said, I think, that the museum will not acquire something unless it can have clear title. And that if in some cases where it's deemed important enough, they might take it in for a little while and then move it along, which could open the door for this kind of agreement. But this focus on preservation, having by my read of it, preservation meaning that the object itself is intact forever, I don't think that's the intention of my work. I sort of follow this principle that a totem is made to go back into the earth. And it tells the story it's meant to tell for the time that it's here, and then it clears space for totems of the future. And if I apply that to the witness blanket, then the job of the witness blanket is to tell people about residential school history. And if and when we get to the point where that's well enough known, it doesn't need to do that work anymore, and it can be put to rest. That doesn't fit into this policy of preservation at all costs. I have a story about a mask that belongs to my family that's in the Museum of Ethnology in Berlin that I can share because it relates really deeply to this question of preservation. The mask is called the Nutlis mask, and it's my last name is Newman. That was the anglicized version of Nutlis. And the mask depicts our ancestor, like our origin story of our family and village. It's a transformation mask, so that starts out as the chief, and then the chief opens, and inside there's a grizzly bear. And the grizzly bear, according to legend, cleared the mouth of the river, allowing us to go up and set up our village. In my culture, when we potlatch, we have what we call a box of treasures. And in that box of treasures are our cultural objects, like masks. When it's time to potlatch, we open the box of treasures and we wake up the masks by singing to them and unwrapping them from the blankets and taking them out. And then we have our potlatch ceremony. And when the ceremony is done, we do the opposite. We sing them back to sleep. We wrap them in blankets and we place them back into the box. When I went to see this mask in the museum in Berlin, at first I was struck by its beauty, because you can see the tool marks and the skill of the carver. And so that's where I was. I'm a carver. I was looking at this as a carver and appreciating, you know, well over 100 years ago, one of my ancestors making this work. But then I was like drawn in like I always am, and I wanted to reach out and touch and hold it. I wanted to dance it. But there's glass, right? It's a museum. It has this beautiful lighting, and it's this perfectly climate-controlled cube. And it was at that point where I started to think about, like, well, when does it get to sleep, right? That's what we do with our masks. We let them sleep. But this mask has light on it at all times. It's in this cage, and it can't be held or sung to even. And so that was kind of like starting to sink in for me. And then I asked what the possibility would be to bring the mask home on loan for a potlatch. And the response was surprising. And I had this kind of idea, because there's two other versions of that mask in existence. One's at the Museum of Anthropology at UBC in Vancouver. The other's in my uncle's box of treasures. So I had this idea of seeing these three generations of masks dance together. And the answer was, well, even if we could lend it to you, which is unlikely because it's extremely valuable. So there's the economic consideration, right? We can't let it go because it's too expensive and something might happen to it. Then it would be impossible for you to ever dance it, because it's been treated with poison to ensure its preservation. Which I guess was a standard practice at a time. And that the focus of the preservation was to maintain the object as a whole, but not the purpose. So what is the object if it is no longer able to fulfill its purpose? And what is, in our belief system, that object has a spirit. What happens to the spirit of the Nutlis mask when you apply poison to save it? Do you save it, or does it end up turning it into a shell of what it was meant to be? Because I think for me, when I think about preservation, I don't just think about the object. I think about the dance that it goes with, the song that it goes with. I think about the ceremony that surrounds it. And all of that is part of the meaning, the knowledge that needs to be preserved. And if it can no longer interact in that way, then I think that only one small aspect of what the object is, or what the culture is being preserved. And so that kind of feeds into this relationship with the witness blanket and this preserving the legacy and all the decisions that are being made in how do you preserve a blanket when it's got braids of hair, hockey skates, a shoe that's deteriorating because it was found in the woods, sweet grass, which is medicine, sage, which is medicine. It's got so many different kinds of material on there. And we're thinking through not only how to care for the object in the best way, but in some cases, when it comes from a particular cultural place, thinking about or learning about and applying how it should be cared for according to that culture. So it's an enormous task, but it's been really enlightening to kind of come up with this notion of, not, I didn't come up with a notion, with applying this notion of objects having a spirit, and then carrying that through a process like conservation, a process like a transaction that sets up a stewardship agreement where nobody owns it. We all share responsibility for it. And it all comes out of that, right? So anyways, that's I know I kind of meandered off into a little side channel there, but.
No, that was fabulous. In our discussions of the policy, what comes up a lot is what we call the social lives of objects. That is what you were talking about, you know, the spirit of an object, about them having lives other than, and a purpose other than just being presented in a museum in a climate-controlled cube. And the policy doesn't really incorporate or acknowledge the social lives of objects. The emphasis in the policy is this very Western notion of preservation. I guess my question is, how do you think museums can better incorporate the social lives of objects and indigenous ways of knowing in their collection policies going forward?
I know, like, resources, both of time and money, are part of a consideration that any institution has to weigh in making these decisions. But I think something as simple as changing your relationship or the way you see your relationship with an object can go a long way to transformation of policy. If a collection is only something that is housed within some designated parameters, whether it's a building, whether it's an archive, and it can only be part of the collection if it's owned by the collection keeper, then that's kind of limiting. But if a collection can be more open than that, if it can exist in multiple different places in the world, and think about any painter, any historical artist, there's a body of work that's made by that person that's considered a collection. But very rarely does one institution hold all of a single collection. So in changing the way you think about relationship with objects, I think you can change maybe the perception of what a collection is and loosen this need, as you said, this sort of Western idea of preservation and collection, and open it a little bit so that it has room for objects to still be part of a collection of knowledge that don't live with the holder of the collection, with the keeper of the collection anymore. There's a few different things, I think, in your question that could be utilized. I was speaking about, in our culture, this sort of idea of objects having agency. I think that's where this idea comes from for me, that then we're not thinking of ourselves as the owners over top of something, but we think of ourselves more in relationship with. And then you're not being guided by all these other sort of the financial aspect and this notion of permanency, but you could still like fulfill. So I was speaking with someone recently and they said to me that dreams unite and visions divide. And when I was reading this policy, I thought about how that statement would apply to this, because early on, it says that the Pitt Rivers Museum would like to be the best in the world. And that's a dream, right? And then I started reading through the policy and I started seeing all of these points. And those points are the vision or a vision of how to achieve that. But I think that that's where the dream starts to become hazy, right? Because it starts to inhibit itself in some ways. I just thought of that when I was reading through the policy, the way that when you start to articulate point after point after point, and you say, well, we'll adhere to this law here and these standards there, that when you go back to the dream, maybe sometimes these different standards and policies conflict with, say, for instance, in my case, acting in the best interest of the object itself. And that's part of the sort of perspective that I grew up with here in this territory, where we have this respect for the past, or we honor the past, we respect the present, and we take responsibility for the future. So that's kind of wrapped up in what a museum does, what an archive does. And then how do you make room for the problematic ways that some things were collected? How do you honor your responsibility to objects? I don't know if this fits in, but I also read in the policy about how the museum won't acquire something unless it can be certain of its origin. And I totally understand with and agree with the intention of that policy, but I was imagining, what if a museum had an opportunity to acquire something for the purpose of repatriation? How many opportunities will be passed up by this policy to set right something that was done in the past, a wrong that was done because of this policy, because they can't take it in? But if you had responsibility to the object, to the history of the object, then you might, if resources allowed, take it in and then not dispose of it, but move it along to the community of origin. And then one last thought I had when I was thinking about this whole notion of disposal and repatriation was that, and it fits into this idea of expanding what a collection could be, is if an object is passed back through repatriation and the loss of having it physically present in the museum isn't seen as it being removed from the collection of knowledge, it's also that the act of working with the community of origin can be an opportunity to develop relationship with the community itself and to continue, if resources allow, to watch and record the development of the history of that object. And I know that's probably a nightmare logistically to think through, but when you start to then add in technology and like the fact that we all have pretty great cameras in our phones now, and we have different ways of uploading and transmitting information, there could be a way of maintaining that relationship over time and growing the body of knowledge that is made available to the public and to students for study, even though the object isn't there anymore, right? And actually enrich that knowledge because it's continuing to grow, because the mask is dancing in the Appalachian.
Yes. Also for the benefit of, well, myself, because I'm not entirely clear on the subject, but also for future listeners who might not know what a potlatch, for the benefit of listeners who might not be clear on that concept, would you mind explaining that to us a little bit?
Sure. A potlatch is a term that we use for ceremony here in my Kwakiwak territory. And it's the best way to describe it. It's sort of our system of governance. But it's also, it's where we take care of the business of society. Marriages happen, agreements are made, treaties are struck, and all of it happens within a big house. All of it happens around a ceremonial fire. All of it is oral, spoken, and all forms of art, legal orders, and governance mix together in that space. None can happen without the other. So a mask that we dance can tell a story and become part of an agreement. And the song that accompanies the dance speaks to that. So it's kind of an amalgamation of so many different things that in current society we hold separately. Like the opera happens over there. The museum holds the artwork over here. We do our law in the courthouse, right? This is a place where all of these things kind of mash together. And communities would come together to work out differences and celebrate or memorialize.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Of course, I am very glad that I asked you that question in particular, because in my limited Canadian Indigenous history knowledge, I had understood it to be something entirely different. So it's fantastic to get that perspective. And speaking of perspectives, that leads us very well into another question that we had. I'm sure you noted in the policy, and we did discuss it a little bit at the beginning, that there's very little discussion of the original owners of these artifacts, very little discussion of who actually made these pieces that now adorn the museum's collection. So as an artist yourself, how would you like to see artists and the original owners of these belongings incorporated into collections practices? Because the museum is now embarking on a more contemporary collecting idea. And do you have any ideas of how they can incorporate the notions of not just past artists, but sort of living and contemporary artists into their policy?
Oh, this is such a big question. I think that in my case, I've taken my lead and my instruction from my community. So when I think about the artwork I make, I don't think about it so much as being proprietary. I think of it as an expression of a cultural expression that comes from, that's passed down and through me. And so I have an interest in some of the work that I make because it's my interpretation of that. But I don't get to completely disassociate my responsibility to community in carrying out what this would become or how it was taken care of in the future. So I would say that I would place more importance in the cultural sense on my community than on me when it comes to how to integrate something into a policy going forward, into collections going forward. In the case of the witness blanket, where we had 886 contributions when we closed the project and started to make the blanket. It's that number's grown because people have continued to make contributions, but that was the number when we finished. I think the responsibility goes to that collective and to trying to honor what that collective, revolves around residential schools. So you can talk about it as being a responsibility to residential school survivors and to sharing the history or the truth of what happened to residential schools. That's where I place importance for that work. When it comes to a totem that I make, I think it goes specifically back to my home community and the way that, say, in a potlatch, we would determine what to do with something, right? Like, I would like my totems that I make to go back into the earth at some point. I don't want them to take up space from future generations because the story that I'm telling with them now is not necessarily going to be relevant in the future. And we see it happening right now in society where people are tearing down statues. Not that they agree with the methods all the time, because that wouldn't be the way that I do it, but that's an expression of change. And those actions, they're the knocking at the door saying, you know, it's time for us to look at these things a little bit differently. It's time to create a different space for statues that memorialize something that we now recognize as being harmful to a large portion of the world population. That doesn't mean that it didn't happen, but I don't think that a statue is history. It's one person's or one era's expression of a portion of history. So I think that back to the sort of core of your question about how artists and communities can be involved in transforming the way the collection occurs. I think about the model of witness that's sort of pretty deeply involved in a lot of the work that I do and the way that we practice culture here in Kwakwaka'wakw territory. And I think about how the witness's job is to listen and to reflect back what they've heard and then to act in a way that's in alignment or accordance to what they heard and shared. And I think that in there is something that could inform a policy. It kind of changes the hierarchy of the museum's position. If a museum becomes a witness that has responsibility to the object and to society, then it's a balance between those things that informs the decision of how to care for an object, how to take it in. And I think that's maybe not exactly like, but something close to what would come from a conversation with Kwakwaka'wakw people about how to do collection management, how to do acquisition. I think that would be, I mean, you never know how many different ways something can go, but that would be one that it kind of brings a smile to my face to think about that ideal. And how would that start to unbraid the power structure, the hierarchy of the way that knowledge is held? I mean, when we're talking about historical objects, there's power there. There's so much power held in those objects, in the knowledge that is within them. And so holding them could be wielded in a lot of different ways, right? But if it were to adhere to that idea of witness and responsibility, then it doesn't get used as a cudgel. It becomes the basis for fulfilling that ideal of making, and I can't remember the exact words, but making this information, this knowledge available to the widest amount of people possible.
To the widest possible audience, yeah. I think you sort of answered also our last question, which was, do you think or how do you think changing collections policies will help to disintegrate power structures between museums and communities?
I kind of started on that a little bit. And I feel like kind of a broken record to keep going back to relationship, but that's where it all comes to for me. And maybe I'll turn it even back to the agreement with the Museum for Human Rights and how we maintain that relationship and we make joint decisions about, as we make joint decisions about how to conserve the objects on the blanket, as we make joint decisions on how to curate, preserve, and share the additional stories that go with it. I mean, in the making of that work, we also gathered, maybe be called field recordings after reading your document, of the process of gathering the objects that are on the blanket, hearing the stories of survivors, walking through residential schools. And so we have like 160 hours of video that digs deep into what happened in residential schools, what they were, what they looked like, what it sounded like to walk through them, the kinds of memories that were evoked for survivors who are adults now when they walk through them. And that's incredibly, like, that's a whole collection in and of itself. And so we've been figuring out how to share that in a way that honors the stories that were told and tries to make sure that they don't just get tucked away. Because we made a 90-minute documentary, but 90 minutes doesn't begin to show everything that we gathered. It's the Coles Notes version of that portion of history. So there's that work, right? How do you do that work together? So we've been pursuing that with the museum and with me and with other interested parties to bring it to life through technological means. In doing so, the museum is taking a leadership role, but not by dictating what happens, by asking, listening, and empowering the words of survivors, empowering the objects themselves. I think that that's a pretty critical piece to this whole thing. In our ways, we have something called qualum, and it's a metaphorical hook that hangs outside the door of a big house. And when you go in, you hang your ego there. And so you go in with humility. And I think when you go into a situation with humility, rather than trying to be an expert, it opens your ears and your heart to continual learning, right? And so, yeah, I've always kind of had I always take a bit of issue with the idea of subject area expert, because even a subject area expert really only has one perspective of that, right? I would consider myself, I would be very, very narrow in the description of anything that I would be called an expert in, or that I would consider myself an expert in. So it wouldn't be in collections. It wouldn't be in any of this. It would be maybe in like how to hold a knife for carving. I'm pretty good at that. The rest of it is me trying to translate the things that I hear from my elders, my family, and then fitting that into the kinds of conversations that result from reading this policy manual and looking at the different words and seeing how sometimes they're in alignment, sometimes they're in conflict with a policy like, or with a set of policies like that. So I think that's one big part. And I think that in this notion of talking about disposal, the act of repatriation, if it's allowed to be led by the community itself, could be seen as a way of further breaking down hierarchy, further leveling of power.
Yes, the policy itself, as I'm sure you know as you read it, is very sparse on repatriation, partly due to necessity. There aren't any actual British guidelines as of yet to repatriation for museums. In Canada, it's pretty well the same. It's not been as much of a big topic as it is becoming right now. So people are still sort of figuring out their own ways to do it. But We would love to hear sort of your final thoughts on this policy and ways that you personally would improve it. We would absolutely love to hear them.
I'm just reading some of my notes here that I was making earlier. I think that I would just restate the idea of expanding the definition of collection and expanding the definition of preservation to include the possibility that something is still part of the Pitt Rivers Museum collection even after it has left the building, especially if it has led to a new and fruitful relationship. I think that the other one is preservation. What does preservation mean if you take away the spirit of or the purpose of a thing? And this idea of what was it called, social lives of objects, because knowledge is held in those social lives. Knowledge is generated from them. The agreement with the Canadian Museum for Human Rights, the stewardship agreement, was generated from the social lives of the objects on the witness blanket. And that's the thing of interest, right? It's a whole different kind of way of thinking about a museum's relationship with a community, with an artist, and with an object in their collection. And it's lifted right up out of a traditional perspective from a particular community, because we went with Kwokwaki'wak ways when we were thinking through this agreement. And we, in the best way we could, married them with Western law. Maybe the last part of that agreement that we didn't talk about that I'll share is the financial component. Because in thinking through how to do a transaction that isn't one for possession, I didn't feel like it was appropriate just to give it over. But I also didn't want to take anything material from the transaction. So what we said about was the aspiration of paying forward the same amount of money, at least the same amount of money that was invested by residential school survivors in making the witness blanket to begin with. Because the funds that came to me to make the blanket came through Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. But it was designated by survivors themselves when they were negotiating the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement. And they set aside an allotment of money to go to commemoration. And that's where I applied with this idea for this blanket. And when I was successful, that money empowered this wealth of material history to be turned into an art project. And so that was the financial terms, was to reinvest in the blanket itself, in the legacy of the survivors, at least the same amount of money that came to make the blanket. That is what is paying for the conservation. That is what is paying for the digital projects to continue. It's turned into a replica of the blanket that is continuing the tour that we were unable to fulfill when the structure of the blanket started to fail. And lastly, it's turned into a legacy project. And so for the legacy project, I'm working to establish a center for arts and decolonization. Actually, I call it the UnCenter for Arts and Decolonization. And we've committed a portion of the money from the transaction to help start that UnCenter. And that's what can happen if you reimagine what it means to acquire something. It can continue to generate new things. Because what I would like to see happen from this UnCenter is to empower artists, knowledge keepers, scholars from across disciplines to make artwork that continues the ideal set out by survivors. Not just to commemorate residential schools, but to participate in reconciliation, to participate in decolonization. So maybe I'll leave it there, that the work of the agreement of the witness blanket is ongoing. And that's, for me, the coolest part of being amidst that project is I still don't know where it will end.
Excellent. And I know in particular, our mentor Marenka will be thrilled to hear about the UnCenter as well. That's something that's so fantastic. I'm sure we'll have to let her know about that, Alexis. I think she'll be just thrilled to hear about that. And thank you so much for coming to speak with us today for some extremely poignant and insightful comments, both on this policy and on the state of museum decolonization in general. It's just been fantastic to speak with you, Professor Newman.
Thank you very much for having me. It was really neat to read through and think through the things. I'm an artist on the West Coast of Canada, and I'm kind of led, as I said, by community or by that responsibility to community. And so whenever I have these opportunities to share it in a wider context, I'm part bewildered, but also extremely grateful for these chances to speak. So thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely. We were thrilled to speak with you.
That was the Pitt Rivers Museum's Matters of Policy podcast, produced by Bessie Woodhouse, Yip Baum, Megan Mann, Alexis Foria, and Bobblehat Sound. Music by Jack Fawcett. Voiceover by Dougal Lott. A special thank you to Marenka Thompson-Odlam and the Knowledge Exchange.